After I finished my second year of seminary, Jennifer and I moved to a town in Illinois called Bloomington. Basically, if you make Illinois a target, Bloomington is like the bullseye. It's right in the center of the state. It's the home of State Farm Insurance. And surrounding Bloomington on every side are farmlands. Usually corn and soybean were the main crops that were grown in central Illinois. And I was basically, one of my tasks there was to be in charge of the youth. And every summer, the youth would start talking about their summer job of walking beans. And I remember thinking, I have no idea what walking beans would mean. You buy a can, you know, of refried beans and walk it around. What does walking beans mean? In the soybean fields, you know, we get paid to walk up and down the rows of these soybeans, chopping down all the weeds that love to grow in the soybean field. And there were times when it was like 90 degrees with 90% humidity, and I remember thinking, I don't think you could pay me enough money, you know, to do that. Well, in our next scripture reading, we're going to find another farmer who's got a very different view of how to handle weeds in his fields, in his crops. Jesus tells this story in the Gospel of Matthew, and may our hearts and our minds be open to hearing the depth of God's word to us through these words. Jesus put before them another parable, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field. But while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, 'Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?' He answered, 'An enemy has done this.' The slaves said to him, Then do you want us to go and gather them?' But he replied, 'No. No, for in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" May God bless again to our hearing and to our listening, this reading from God's holy word. Now, I did not grow up in central Illinois. I grew up in Southern California. My dad was not a soybean farmer, but as I've said to you before, I was what you might call a forced volunteer weeder. It wasn't a state, it was a small suburban home where he had his prized dichondra grass. I know I've shared this before, and I realize today in mentioning it, maybe this is part therapy for me to keep telling you about this. You're out there for 2 or 3 hours, you know, at 6, 7 years old, weeding for that long, you begin to think, aren't there child labor laws about this kind of stuff? But my dad had us weeding, you know, all the time, my brother Bruce and me, So I was infused at an early age with a hatred for weeds. You know, whenever I would see one somewhere, I would feel a compulsion to pick it. You know, wherever it would be, weeds do not belong. Which got me in some trouble in my marriage. Because Jennifer loves planting perennials. And she would plant these perennials, and she would say to me, "Look, I just planted something. I know you're going to want to pull it because you think it's a weed, but don't do it. Just don't do it." I won't. Of course I won't. And the plant would grow, and my weed attraction eyes would say, "Oh, there's a weed." And I would pull it. I know. Right, exactly. Pretty much what Jennifer did. She went out in the yard, saw this hole where her perennials had been, and she said, What did you do?" "I'm just weeding." "No, you pulled out an important plant." In fact, the worst thing I did was that her dad had sent her some really beautiful lily bulbs that would grow to 6 feet tall if you let them. But when they got to be about 4 inches high, I'm amazed that she forgave me. I'm amazed we're still married, because I could tell that was something that really, really caused some deep frustration and anger. And I learned the power of grace and forgiveness. Sometimes you just want to pull the weeds, but then you find out maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I plucked up something that, if allowed to grow, would have become something beautiful. And I think that understanding, you know, is at the heart of this parable. This landowner has planted some really good seed, wheat seed apparently, and starts to grow, but somebody playing with the landowner has planted weed seeds, we're told. And the weeds start to grow up with the wheat, and the people tending to the land notice all these weeds, and they say, "What do you want us to do?" Now, if I had been the foreman, I know what I would have done. "We're going to war, boys. Grab the tools, the axe, the hoe. We're going to take down all these weeds. We're going to show them they do not belong on this soil." The landowner takes a different route. Says, "No, no, no. Stand down. It's okay. Put away your weeders, your weed whackers. You know, it's okay. We'll let the weeds grow up with the weeds." When the right time arrives, when the wheat has fully grown, then we'll pull all the plants out, and then we'll separate, you know, the wheat from the weeds. And back in Jesus' day, apparently there was a kind of wheat called the darnel. I don't know if it's still around, but apparently part of the problem with darnel is it really resembles wheat in some way, so even a trained eye sometimes won't know, is this a weed or is this wheat? So Landers says, we're not going to try any weeding here. He's not concerned, like my dad was, about a weed-free field or lawn. It's all right, let him grow. I'm not trying to win a contest for the cleanest-looking harvest. I want to maximize my harvest of wheat. Now, Jesus used a lot of nature-based imagery in his parables. He's not trying to give advice to the wheat farmers of Palestine in the story. He's not thinking about those kinds of plants. Earlier on in Matthew's gospel, he says these words. He says, we're told by Matthew, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the gospel, and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless. A little dig there at the religious leaders of the day. They were like sheep without a shepherd, another dude. Then he said to the disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are so few. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into God's harvest field. Again, not talking here about soybeans or wheat or corn. He's talking about people. Jesus looks everywhere and he sees people everywhere. And he's thinking, you know, my mission is to try to make sure that the people are drawn into the life of God. That they begin to experience what it means to know God the way that I do, that they would be able to understand how deeply they are loved and cherished and wanted. For what Christ wants to do is to gather people, not into a barn, but into the kingdom of heaven, to gather them into a family of faith, where they will know henceforth that they are indeed part of this incredible, beloved reality of God. So as we're told, the way he goes about this is he's eating with outcasts. He's having parties with sinners. He's healing people. He's touching lepers. He's around all the people that the religious leaders of that day would consider to be weeds. The spotted spurge, the dandelions, the crabgrass of culture. And he's not walking fields of soybeans. He's walking through roads and byways and alleyways, trying to figure out how do I allow grace to be sown, for faith to be developed, for love indeed to be harvested. And his approach is so diametrically opposed to the Pharisees and the other leaders of the religious establishment of the day, who go around not using weeders and weed whackers and hoes and scythes. They're using words and looks and laws to make it clear you do not belong anywhere near God. And they use judgment and exclusion, oppression, rejection, shame, accusation. They're going around making sure everybody they see as a weed in culture knows that they really are needed. They need a dollop of spiritual roundup. We want to destroy you, to get rid of you, to make you feel you do not belong. That God only cares about virtuous people like us. And they were ruthless in their weeding out of those they considered to be beneath God's holiness standard. And again, Jesus calls them out and embodies this different way of caring for those they consider to be weeds. And it drove the religious leaders crazy. How can you do that? They would ask the disciples, why does your teacher associate and hang out with the spotted spurge and the dandelions and the darnels of culture? Why is he not trying to separate the holy from the unholy? Why is he commingling himself with all of these people who have no right, no justification to be treated with care and love by God? And they just could not wrap their mind around. They couldn't understand what Jesus' farming approach was, but it was based on the idea that only God has enough wisdom and discernment and the right as the Creator to be able to really judge any human heart with any degree of accuracy and finality. And so he says, look, let's let God alone handle judging which people are good or bad, righteous, unrighteous, holy, unholy. Let's stop the whole weeding and condemning apparatus, and let's change our focus to something else. Do what I do. Don't be concerned about judging, condemning, labeling, excluding. I want you to welcome, to bless, to love, to care, to reach out. He understood that human beings have this innate desire or need somehow, to do this kind of thing. And it certainly has existed and flourished in the Christian tradition as well. You go back a few centuries, for example, when the Pope signed the Doctrine of Discovery in the early 1400s, that gave permission to all the European powers to go to wherever they wanted to, into the New World, and to pluck people, uproot them, take their land, kill them if they resist, because somehow these people really weren't people, not like us. And so there was a theological justification that baptized the whole approach of separating people from being those who were godly from those who had a right to be killed, whose land was free to be taken. The church stepped in line to endorse that. And in our country, for example, it's also very clear that a lot of reading about this, and even in our own denomination as Presbyterians, that there was indeed, as we know, the blessing of separating people by race. At some point, black people were allowed to come into white churches, but only if they stayed in the balcony. They weren't allowed to commingle because you don't mix weeds and wheat, was the thinking. The church had a hard time really treating women as equal to men throughout its history. You still see it today in many parts of Christendom. Somehow your gender makes you less able, less spiritual, less chosen by God to be a leader. The church has taken harsh, weeding stances towards people on the LGBTQ continuum. Your lifestyle, your orientation excludes you. You don't belong. You're unholy. And what does that do to a human soul? A soul created by God. Or one time I went to visit a woman in my last church. She was a gay woman. And she was in the mental unit, the mental health unit of University of Michigan. I went to visit her. And she had been at our church for a couple of years. And she seemed to be growing in her faith. But something took place that caused her to feel suicidal. And I went and I talked to her and I said to her, "What's going on?" And she said, "I know in my heart that I'm an abomination in God's eyes. I know God despises me." I said, "Why? Why would you think that? Why would you think that God thinks you're an abomination, that you're destined for hell?" She said, "Because my church told me that when I was growing up. They prayed over me and tried to cast out demons, and they said to me, 'You don't belong here.' And I realized no matter how much then I was trying to convince her that's not who God is like, that's not who Jesus revealed God to be like, nothing seemed to penetrate. She was convinced because she was told at a young age that this is the reality for those who are like that." I remember thinking, I was such grief and frustration, and I remember thinking, to live with that perspective is devastating. And I asked myself, what is God feeling right now to see one of his daughters believing that he condemns her as an abomination? And she learned that from his body, the church. Could anything cause God more anger, frustration, pain than that? See, the church has such an obligation to stand for the revelation of Christ that all people are part of the family of God. And it's never the church's job to condemn, to judge, to malign, to exclude anybody because we think we know who the weeds are. We don't. Only God can figure that out. And part of the reality is, if we're honest about it, all of our hearts are filled with weeds and wheat. Do any of us think ever we could stand before God and say, "Here I am, I'm weed free, accept me"? Or do all of us need a massive dose of grace? And so why would we be reluctant to extend that to others because of our own need to judge, to condemn, to malign? We live now in a time in our world where many people are being pointed at, "You're disgusting, you're a problem, you have no rights, you shouldn't be here. What's wrong with you?" And the church can't stand up in such times and say, "No. It is never right to start doing this to other human beings." And the church can't do that. It's lost one of its central purposes. The culture will take the condoning of the church or the silence of the church and say, okay, it must be all right. Because the people that are supposed to be advocating for the marginalized, the targeted, they're keeping their mouths shut or they're actually saying things to justify. We live in such a time now. Outrage politics. Who are we disgusted by? Who needs to be targeted and robbed of their rights and excluded from being part of this nation? The church has made this mistake over and over and over again. The church, many parts of the church in Germany, even supported Hitler's ideology. Now, thank God there have always been resistors, prophets, people who risked to speak out, but often the institutional church fell in line with the prevailing cultural perspective, not standing against it when it was needed. And it's caused so much pain, tragedy, fueled genocide. May we today, as part of the family of God, as part of the legacy of Christ, may we indeed understand it's never our job to condemn, to malign, to decide, oh, you're in, you're out, you're a weed, you're a weed. It's only God's job. God alone has that prerogative. Our task, as Jesus says, is to love enemies. Pray for those who've hurt you. Be forbearing to one another. Extend grace, even if you don't think it's deserved. Offer it anyway. Forgive 70 times 7. Live in a way where indeed, through love, maybe the weeds in our heart get transformed by the power of God. That's what the Holy Spirit loves to do, to take something that's weedy and dark within each of us and says, let me bring light and hope into you. And our job is not to get in the way of that. Support it, to nurture it, to encourage it, to pray for it, to model it in our lives together and in our lives out in our world. These are dark times. And God formed us to be a light, to be a different kind of community, humanity. And may we be up for the challenge. May God give us the courage, the hope, and the trust to live in the Spirit of Christ. It's in His name alone that we give all praise and honor and glory.